From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Senate leaders hope to approve a budget deal today to keep the government operating past midnight. The Senate has been working on a two-year plan, the House on a shorter extension of funding. Neither plan deals with immigration and the Dreamers. I spoke earlier with Senator Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat from Illinois, and asked her if she could support this deal, even though those immigration issues are left out.
Well, I think that we do need to address the Dreamers. I don't know that we need to address it as part of the budget deal. Remember that on the Senate side, Senator McConnell, the Republican leader, has made a commitment to allow us to actually do a regular order deal and floor vote on it.
So do you think that'll happen before the deadline in March?
Well, that's the goal, is that it needs to happen before the deadline, or we need to do something with the deadline because we need to protect the Dreamers and keep them from being deported.
As a veteran, what do you think about some of the other news this week? President Trump wants to have a military parade. He's asked the Pentagon to draw plans for that.
Well, I think that it shows that he is truly not fit to be commander-in-chief of our military. We have troops who are in harm's way right now. We have Secretary Tillerson talking about sending Americans into Syria on a permanent basis, and our president wants to spend hard-earned taxpayer dollars on a parade. That's simply ridiculous.
You think it'll happen?
Well, he's a commander-in-chief, and if he gives the order, the military will have to carry it out because it's a lawful order. But it is a foolish one and not one that is based on any thing that will help our military men and women. You know, if he wants to spend that kind of money, it will be hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to do something like that. Then let's send that to the troops or send it to their family members. Let's not blow it on a parade for Trump's ego.
Earlier this week, the president called Democrats who didn't applaud during his State of the Union address treasonous. You fired back in a tweet saying, "We don't live in a dictatorship or monarchy. I swore an oath in the military and in the Senate to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, not to mindlessly cater to the whims of cadet bone spurs and clap when he demands I clap." Do you think these things are distractions, or what makes you feel that you should respond when he says something like that people are being treasonous for not clapping?
Because he gets away with it unless someone calls him out who has the standing to call him out on these types of things. He did the same thing when he accused Democrats of not supporting our military during the budget fight. It's simply not true. And he cannot be allowed to put out rhetoric out there that hurts our nation. We are the leading democracy on the face of the earth. This is not a place where you call somebody treasonous because they reject the opinions of those who are in power. If anything, it's the most American thing you can do, is to speak up, stand up and speak your mind and oppose those who are in power.
Have you gotten any blowback for going up against him on this issue?
I have not gotten any blowback. And in fact, I've gotten a lot of people who appreciated me standing up for the Constitution.
You mentioned the Secretary of State talking about a long-term presence in Syria for U.S. troops. Meanwhile, we're watching what's happening in Afghanistan. The president has recommitted the U.S. To the war there. Do you think there's any end ever in sight for the war in Afghanistan?
As long as we do not have a new authorization for use of military force, I don't see how there is an end to our conflicts in the Middle East. It's why I have been pushing so hard for my colleagues and I to debate and develop a new authorization for use of military force that will actually talk about what the end state needs to be, that will talk about what the parameters are. Until then, we have ceded the dialogue to the administration. We will just continue to move forward without Congress's oversight, which is our constitutional duty.
What about in Iraq? We're hearing this week that some troops are being moved out of Iraq and to Afghanistan.
Well, I think that we should be bringing American troops out of Iraq, not necessarily to send them to Afghanistan. But again, we are in a position where the American people have no idea what the mission is, what the end state is, what the off-ramp is. And we can't just continue to spend the most precious resource we have, which is the lives of the men and women who wear the uniform of this country, in the careless way that we seem to be doing.
One more thing, Senator. You and your husband, Brian, are now expecting your second child. So congratulations on that. You're going to be the first sitting senator to give birth. What is that like for you?
Well, we are very, very happy. I'm sure it's not going to be any different than any working mom who's trying to juggle her work life and her personal life. It is somewhat ridiculous that it's 2018 and this is such big news.
Right.
But it says something about the need for more women in leadership, not just here in the Senate, although we sorely need them, but also all across America, whether it's in boardrooms or, you know, in all across our nation.
How much time do you think you're going to take off?
Well, I'm not quite sure yet. We're still working on that. I'm the first because I am the first. There are no maternity parental leave policies for senators, especially those who actually give birth. So I will be working with the administration of the Senate to set some of the ground rules and develop the policies. I guess when you're the first one, you have the opportunity to really push to set what the rules are for everyone.
Well, congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
And that's Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois. Senator, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, from Chicago to Milwaukee to Columbus, there's been an uptick across the country in shootings at wakes and vigils where families grieving victims of gun violence come under attack. In the past 2 years in Florida's Miami-Dade County alone, there were shootings at 3 wakes and 1 vigil, all of which are still unsolved and left 5 people dead and at least 7 injured. Nadez Green from member station WLRN has this report on how families, funeral homes, and police are dealing with shootings at wakes.
Serena Harrell says her 15-year-old son, Isaiah Solomon, was inconsolable when he found out that his cousin was shot multiple times in a failed robbery attempt.
I had never seen Isaiah weep like that for someone.
A few days later, Isaiah went with a relative to his cousin's wake. Harrell received a frantic phone call late in the evening. There was a drive-by shooting at the wake. Isaiah was shot dead.
I was just speaking about this the other day, and I was saying that it is no longer safe to even go to a wake.
Someone else was killed in that shooting, and at least 3 injured. In interviews with families, funeral home directors, and law enforcement, WLRN found it's not uncommon for wakes or vigils to be threatened or targeted.
In some instances, we are contacted by the police where they think it may be retaliation because of the circumstances surrounding the homicide.
Terry Wright is the director of Wright & Young Funeral Home in Miami-Dade. He says he gets about 3 calls a year from police telling him the funeral he's planning needs extra security. These funerals are always for someone killed by gun violence, and police are still in the early stages of their investigation. So Wright allows police to attend those wakes and funerals.
Uniform and patrol car. They're not undercover. We need to let them know that we have law enforcement here, because if you undercover, anything could pop off.
He understands the need to keep his staff and mourners safe, but
you're coming to pay homage to the person who's passed. That means respect.
You shouldn't have to have security at a wake.
Lori Hadley Davis is a mortician and the owner of Hadley Davis Funeral Homes. She says nearly all of the funerals she plans for victims of gun violence require police presence.
Because a lot of the wakes be shot up from people that's in gangs and territories and that type of stuff.
Like, why? Why shoot at a wake or a vigil?
They're heartless. They ain't got no respect. They ain't got nothing.
And she says, because there's a good chance someone at the wake or vigil is a target. She knows this on a very personal level. Last year, Hadley Davis's niece, Jada Page, was shot and killed in front of her grandmother's house. Jada was 8.
When she died, we had the wake fully secure. Why? Because they wasn't after her. They was after her father.
Jada's dad, James Page, was also hit in that shooting. He survived. His presence at his daughter's wake raised safety concerns that the shooters who didn't kill him might show up.
We going to see if he going to be there so we can finish off what we should have did in the first place.
Everyone just hold the candle in the air.
Dozens of mourners filled a park in the Miami neighborhood of Overtown holding white balloons. It was a vigil for Jedediah Scatliff. The 18-year-old was killed at a wake in another park nearby. The crowd formed a circle on the field. 6 police officers stood guard near the circle, some in full uniform, others in bulletproof vests that read, "Police."
I can't do it.
Jedediah's mom, Travelle Harris, could barely stand as the crowd released their white balloons into the air. Her nickname for her son was Eggie.
My baby, with me. My baby, Eggie, please.
As the crowd slowly made its way out the park, there were even more police officers. At least 8 marked cars lined the streets. Major Esther Farmer is with the City of Miami Police Department, which is investigating Jedediah's killing. She used to be the commander of the Overtown community where he was killed.
If we have intel, information that something may happen, the vigil would be a target, by all means, we would come out and we would show that we're here, we're with you, and please grieve in peace.
Farmer would not talk about the specifics of Jedediah's case because the investigation is still ongoing. But she says the hardest part of keeping a vigil or awake safe is getting the information that it could potentially be a target in the first place.
So we have to go out there and we have to talk to the community, and the community have to trust us and give us the information.
She says that trust part doesn't come easy, but the act of mourning should be sacred. For Here and Now, I'm Nadege Green in Miami.
It was the incident that electrified the world. In August 2015, 3 American tourists on a high-speed train bound for Paris took down a terrorist armed with an assault rifle, a gun, a knife, and well over 200 rounds of ammunition. The young men, Anthony Sadler, Alex Garlados, and Spencer Stone, along with Briton Christopher Norman, who also helped in the takedown, were later given France's highest decoration, the Legion of Honor, by President Hollande.
Monsieur Alexander Garlados. Au nom de la République française, je vous fais chevalier de la Légion d'honneur.
Now their story is told in the new film, The 1517 to Paris, directed by no less than Clint Eastwood. And we see what happened before the attack. We watch as the gunman makes his way through the train. Other passengers try to stop him. One gets shot. Then he bursts into the car with the 3 young men. And it really is the 3 young men. They play themselves. Spencer Stone charging down the thin aisle of the moving train car to the gunman, pointing an assault rifle right at him.
Spencer, go!
And the gun jams. The 1517 to Paris opens in theaters tomorrow. And joining us from NPR New York today, the 3 stars. Anthony Sadler, you there?
I'm here.
Alex Garlados?
I'm here.
And Spencer Stone?
Here.
Welcome to you all. What are you thinking now that it's on the big screen? Spencer, start with you.
Man, it is just crazy. I mean, the movie, when it first came about, was crazy enough. But then for us to be offered to play ourselves by Clint Eastwood was something that we never even thought was in the realm of possibility.
No.
And to, just be a little over 2 years past the attack is just a crazy feeling. I don't feel like sometimes we can wrap our heads around it.
Well, I can't imagine. I can't imagine. It's not even enough time just for the trauma of that day. But let's just go back a little further, as the film does, because it reminds us that you were childhood friends and got in a lot of trouble. And Anthony, no offense, but I feel you were the ringleader.
To a certain extent, I guess you can say that. We weren't really doing anything that 12-year-old boys weren't commonly doing. So the film kind of portrays us as that, and we did get into some trouble, but nothing too major. We just 12-year-old boys doing regular things.
You mean like toilet paper in a house kind of thing?
Yeah.
Teepee, doorbell ditching, things like that.
Nothing too crazy.
But talk a little bit more about that. I mean, I want to know how much is true. At least it seems Alec and Spencer, the children of single moms, schools that you went to, were assigning a lot of the blame for your, rambunctiousness on your moms. Did that really happen?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The school we went to was a school that liked to get a little overly involved in people's personal lives, and but
that's tough.
But that's what prompted us to move on and get out of there.
Well, and how about the fascination with war? And you played, out in the woods and the leaves and everything, war, you're dead. But then also had a teacher who encouraged your interest in past battles.
Honestly, he was just probably the person we latched onto just because he, I think, saw a little bit of potential in us that nobody else saw, maybe.
Yeah. And I mean, we all bonded kind of a mutual hate for the school we were going to. And his classroom was more of a safe haven because we didn't feel like we were at the school we were in when we were in his classroom.
Yeah. Throughout the film, there seems to be an inevitability. It's like you're all on this path that's going to meet on this train. Does it feel that way for you, Anthony? Different paths, but all on one that would merge.
Yeah, most definitely. It's kind of been the story of our relationship in general. We all went to our different paths in life. I was in college, and these two decided to join the military. So, I mean, that's just the nature of our story, and I think it just represents, you know, the journey that life has us on. You don't necessarily always get to do it with best friends, but our lives up until then were leading up to that moment for sure.
Yeah. Let's listen to a scene where, you know, we hear a little foreshadowing of that. You're on this trip through Europe, you know, a great adventure that friends having a reunion have. And the decision to go from Amsterdam to Paris was one you kept rethinking. And you get philosophical about it. Let's listen.
No. You should have heard this guy. He was talking about how life is catapulting him towards something like some greater purpose or something like that.
Spencer said that.
I know. Right.
You still think that?
I mean, I guess, but nothing's actually stopping us. If we weren't meant to be on the train tomorrow, something would physically stop us. An object in motion stays in motion unless acted upon by a greater force.
Okay, Isaac. Come on.
Did you really have that conversation, Spencer, before you got on that train?
Not in those exact words, but along those lines, yes. I mean, every conversation in the movie is based off conversations that we've had.
It just didn't sound quite that philosophical.
Yes, I wasn't that elegant with my words at the time.
But essentially you were saying, if I got this right, look, let's get on the train because if we're not meant to get on the train, something will prevent us from it. So let's just roll with it.
Exactly. You know, we just kind of felt like we were going in the direction that we naturally were supposed to. And we said, hey, you know, let's just plan on leaving. And if something comes up, then, you know, hey, we'll stay.
Alec, talk about the moment you're on the train. We see the gunman doing his preparations, going into the bathroom on the train. We see what's coming. What was that like for you to see that thing you didn't know was happening while you're sitting there with your earbuds in, you know, on this train ride?
Well, it's nice just because a lot of stuff happened before we got involved. And it kind of helps to give the other passengers like Mark McGallion and Damien credit for what they did, because if they didn't do what they did, we probably wouldn't have been able to survive and do what we did. I mean, everything kind of played out that way for a certain reason.
Okay, and you just mentioned something, and we've been wondering. There are other passengers on the train. Some get shot. Are they the real people?
Yes, there's Mark McGallion plays himself. His wife plays herself. Chris Norman plays himself. Some of the train employees play themselves as well. Some of the EMT crews and police that come on board, they all play themselves. It was just kind of a surreal experience doing it all again with the same people, especially the only person that didn't really was the terrorist.
Yeah. Spencer, you're the one who charges the terrorist. Thank God the gun jams initially.
Mm-hmm.
But then, oh, look, he's got a knife. You were horribly slashed, and there is that scene where the three of you now you're holding him down and the three of you are trying to keep him down. Wasn't that a little bit stomach-churning?
In the time, on the day of the actual attack, not really, to be honest, because the amount of adrenaline that's rushing through you numbs a lot of your senses. Mm-hmm. Looking at it on the screen is obviously like a whoa, you know, like we can't believe we did that or like this happened to us. But in the moment, you're not really thinking about much other than just trying to survive.
Well, I was thinking too, having seen, you know, you as a child and in the Air Force, you know, when there was a drill, everybody was supposed to stay in their seat. No, you run to the door. The reflexes that got you in trouble a lot were the
ended
ones
ended up being the things that saved us.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
One last thought about that sort of Spencer, the kid, and then the cadet who kind of, you know, screwed up maybe a little bit, but it was sometimes in the way of jumping out to defend or to make a statement or to whatever. I have to remind people that after this was all over later, you were involved in an altercation in the States outside a nightclub defending a female friend, and you were stabbed again, this time life-threatening injuries. So we have to ask, is there something about you, Spencer Stone, that's just always going to be ready to defend?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to take no crap. But, I mean, at the end of the day, even on the train in real life, I don't think me, Alec, or Anthony would have been able to live with ourselves if we went in the other direction. Maybe even say we jumped off the train somehow and survived. we would have found out later hundreds of people were dead and we had a moment to do something and we passed it up. I don't think that's something we could have lived with for the rest of our lives. And same goes as on the street in Sacramento. You know, if I would have just stood there and let the girl I was with get stabbed to death, then I don't know what I'd do with myself. So I would kind of rather just take that road than
unfortunately he didn't have backup.
Yes. Yeah.
You now have to travel in groups of three, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. You should see our posse these days. We roll deep.
Well, and Alec, it's one thing to have this happen in real life. Was it hard to recreate the person that could react in a moment? Was it hard to act that?
Yes and no. I mean, it was definitely strange. And of course, not being actors probably was a little bit tougher than normal. But at the same time, doing it again with Mr. Eastwood, he took such lengths and effort to make sure everything was exactly the same the day of that it made it really easy for us to kind of get back in that mindset that we were on the day of the train. Because, I mean, we were wearing the same clothes. It was the same train. We had some of the same passengers. So it was very easy for us to feel the same emotions and do the same things that we did that day.
Yeah. Anthony, you guys were celebrated. Now here you're up on the screen. How do you feel about how people look at you now?
It's an extremely humbling experience having people receive us so well and what we did. And we don't take that lightly. And it's something that we add to our memories and we're extremely grateful for it.
Spencer, is it also this? Is this movie also about encouraging others? Are you saying, you know, we did this, you can do this?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of the moral of our story is that we're just three ordinary guys that were put into a crazy situation. And I think it proves that anyone is capable of the extraordinary. But at the same token, I'm not saying that you should run into a man with a loaded AK-47. You know, every situation is different. But you can always do something. You can call the cops. You can rush people away or, you know, even just the smallest thing. As long as you're doing something to contribute, I think the world would be a better place.
That's Spencer Stone, Anthony Sadler, Alex Garlatos. They star in a recreation of what they did, taking down a terrorist on the 1517 to Paris. That's the name of the new film. Thank you all for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Shares in Twitter jumped this morning after the social media company reported its first quarterly profit ever, $91 million. In an earnings call, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey listed some other positive signs he's watching.
We're seeing a lot more engagement. We're seeing a lot more retweets, and we're seeing a lot more mentions. And we're also seeing people get more followers and return more often.
Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One and joins us now. Hi, Robin.
How are you, sir?
Doing well, and this $91 million profit must be welcome news at Twitter. The company has seen multiple rounds of layoffs. Are things finally looking up?
Yeah, I think the hope is Twitter has finally figured out a baseline business model, at least. I mean, Twitter's been indispensable to the world of social media. You can see news live tweeted before it ever even hits the news wires. I mean, I saw Amtrak passengers yesterday broadcasting an incident before Penn Station or Amtrak ever got around to it. But the problem is Twitter has been treading water financially since it IPO'd, I think, you know, 5 years ago.
They haven't been able to figure out how to monetize their product.
Yeah, and it's a meaning of life question for every company because Facebook and Google dominate the world of internet advertising and everybody's kind of been an also-ran.
So during this profitable quarter, $91 million, Twitter did something that got a lot of attention. It doubled the limit on the number of characters allowed in each tweet, 280 instead of 140. Did that make a difference here?
Well, you know, Jeremy, I think on the margin it allows for more bloviating. You can check right out my Twitter feed. I think I'm woefully underfollowed. I like to soliloquize like I'm a big deal. But you've also, you know, on top of that, I've been seeing more autoplay ads and sponsored tweets. I don't know how many I mute in a day, but I digress. Just don't mute me. In all seriousness, I think that the bigger feature here is the Happening Now feature, which is useful for kind of on-demand sports highlights, and that's hurting things like SportsCenter. You can go in and try to put in the Nick Foles or Philly hashtag and get instant gratification. But the question still remains, how do you get profitable revenue out of even a more engaged user base?
And how much of a concern is a drop in the number of users? The users in the U.S. fell slightly to 68 million, Twitter says.
Look, both zombie accounts and trolls are a huge problem for Twitter. You look at that recent New York Times investigation about fake users. And no growing internet company, especially a publicly traded one, wants to have to cull its user base. But at the same time, I think Twitter management's being pressured by users and advertisers to show real reach numbers. And companies want hard metrics before they fork over hard ad dollars.
How much of a problem do you think Twitter faces when it comes to how negative Twitter can be? I'm thinking of, you know, first thing in the morning when I get up, I look at my phone and then I go, maybe I shouldn't look at my phone so quickly. But once I do, I would much rather go to Instagram in the morning, frankly, than Twitter.
It's a negative place, especially if you consider the tweeter-in-chief, Donald Trump, with his huge following. I mean, the leader of the free world likes to dispense with PR handlers right. And confess his vanities and talk smack straight into his phone. I mean, I wish Stanley Kubrick was still alive. But look, it cuts both ways. I mean, you and I, we use it, we love it, we hate it, we get our news there. Right. It makes us feel terrible. We swear it off and we come back to it.
Well, for now anyway, Robin Farzad, host of The Full Disclosure on NPR One. And Robin, your Twitter address is?
@ Robin Farzad. Follow me. Love me.
Millions of tourists drive into Banff National Park in the Canadian Rockies every year to climb the soaring mountains, hike around turquoise lakes, and catch a glimpse of some of the wild animals like the grizzly bears that call the park home. But Canada's busiest highway, the Trans-Canada, cuts through this rugged landscape, and the park is home to two towns and three ski hills. So animals traveling into and through Banff have to navigate carefully. There are some solutions. You may have heard of animal crossings. Molly Siegel from WHYY's The Pulse explains.
A bit slippy here with the ice.
Erin Jacob and I walk along a trail in the Rocky Mountains just east of Banff.
As a kid, I remember seeing roadkill and thinking it was how colossally unfair it was.
Today, Jacob is a biologist. We're on our way to look at a pathway designed for animals to safely cross the Trans-Canada Highway. This trail is popular with mountain bikers, dog walkers, and wild animals. As we near a clearing, Jacob stops to look at some scat.
What's that? I actually usually can't help pass without picking up a stick and picking it apart. But it's a little hard to tell, so there's some seeds in it.
She thinks it may be from a black bear, but there are about 50 species of mammals in Banff National Park. So whatever critter left this scat could have been on its way to the highway crossing we're looking for.
This is just this little clearing.
At a clearing off the trail, we can see the underpass. It's as if the dirt has been scooped out from under the highway, which passes over the indent like a bridge.
We should stay a fairly good distance away. We're about 30 meters from it right now.
Erin Jacob says this animal throughway is important, both to keep animals from becoming roadkill and to maintain ecosystems.
Having animals be able to mate, so having healthy, diverse populations of animals mating, it also means having them move through landscapes and disperse nutrients. So an animal like a bear is really important because they help to disperse nutrients from rivers up into the forests and vice versa. That's what ecology is all about. It's having this interconnected ecosystem.
I go for a ride with another biologist, Tony Clevenger.
You know, these structures are designed to be really site-specific wildlife corridors.
He's showing me some of the other crossing designs hidden throughout Banff. We climb over a wildlife fence, which looks like oversized chicken wire, and down a steep embankment to a dark and narrow underpass, a long tunnel beneath the highway.
You could imagine, you know, prey species maybe not being so keen about going through something like this. You know, the visibility is not real good. It's not a lot of light. We know that small, medium-sized critters as well have a hard time going through these because it's completely bare on the bottom. There's no cover for them to get through.
This is one of the first crossings built in Banff in the mid-1980s. Until Tony Clevenger started monitoring them in 1997, no one knew for sure what species were using these pathways to cross the highway, when, or how often. Using hair traps, animal tracks, and eventually remote cameras allowed him to see that, yes, animals were using these structures, but use varied by species.
Wildlife use all different structure types, but there were certain preferences.
Clevenger's research showed that cougars and black bears like these narrow and dark culverts that run under the highway. But ungulate species, like elk, deer, and moose, generally prefer to use crossings with more light and visibility. So, when Banff National Park built more wildlife crossings, Clevenger suggested modifications.
From that monitoring, we were able to design structures on this last stretch of highway that meet the needs of the species that are out there.
Now Banff has a few dozen underpasses. The designs are different shapes, heights, widths, and lengths. And then there are the overpasses.
These overpasses now are 20 years old.
They look like tree-lined bridges.
Now, these big structures are by far the most important.
That's because their data revealed that while male grizzlies used any route possible to cross highways, breeding females, moms with cubs, almost exclusively used the bridges. To maintain genetic diversity and the future of grizzly bear populations, those breeding females need to feel safe crossing highways.
These are very wide structures. They have good visibility. They are the most natural type of structure. You know, some people call these landscape bridges because they look just like the landscape.
Tony Clevenger has taken what he's learned here in Banff across North America and the world. So if you find yourself cruising through an area like Banff, think of another world of animal commuters taking the bridges across and the underpasses below. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Siegel.
And Molly's story comes to us from WHYY's health and science program, The Pulse. Let's go to Colorado now, where the Department of Transportation has found that wildlife crossings are reducing animal-related car crashes there by, in some spots, up to 90%. Colorado has built more than 30 passages across the state. Some can cost up to $1 million. Mark Lawler is a biologist with the Colorado Department of Transportation, or CDOT. Mark, how do you choose where to put these crossings?
Well, working for the Colorado Department of Transportation, providing safety to the motorist is our priority. And as we look at terrain and locations where we see a lot of wildlife motorist conflict, we look for spots where we have the highest degree of conflict. And those would be the locations where we try to prioritize crossings for the wildlife so that we can build fence and provide a corridor for motorists where they won't encounter wildlife on the roadway.
Yeah. Well, just remind people who maybe don't have as much wildlife where they live. You know, when wildlife meets car, it can be devastating.
It is. Certainly, the big game species we have here in Colorado cause a lot of damage for motorists, to vehicles. They can even cause injury and, of course, in extreme cases, fatalities. About 80% of our wildlife vehicle collisions with big game are from collisions with mule deer. We also are concerned about the collisions with elk. Those seem to be the two that produce the most damage to property and to people.
Well, and now you've got these remote cameras installed at some of these crossings. What are you seeing?
We monitor our structures after they're completed, and we want to make sure that animals are using them. I see a lot of mule deer using them. Mule deer readily find these structures. They're guided by the exclusion fencing, and they use the structures to get below or over the roadways. We also see small mammals. We've seen some predators use these structures, bear and coyotes. So quite a few different species, but we usually build them to target the larger game that really can endanger our motorists.
And you've already explained that you are looking for the routes that the animals take. You're not trying to guide animals to your tunnel. You're trying to build the tunnel where they would naturally go. But how do you keep, is there a concern about keeping humans away from the tunnels if they know they're going to see animals there?
We do try to keep people out of the structures, their pets as well. We want the structures to have a real encouraging odor and have an openness for wildlife, and having people there and their pets can deter some of that utilization. So we try to fence them out. Occasionally we sign these areas requesting that the public doesn't enter these areas, because we just want the utilization by wildlife to be maximized so we get the greatest benefit from these structures.
And as we said, they're expensive, but you have a drastic drop in accidents and your animals are safer. How are Coloradans reacting?
We've received lots of positive input on these from both fronts. One, motorists who perhaps have had negative experiences from collision now have portions of roadways where that's not a huge concern. And we also have seen benefit for the animals. Well, we've seen number of mule deers hit in areas drop dramatically. And we also feel like we're enabling their seasonal movements and their daily movement so that they're able to access those important habitats that are essential for their survival. So really, we've got a positive gain on two fronts, motorist safety and still enabling permeability to the wildlife.
Yeah. That's Mark Lawler of the Colorado Department of Transportation. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
My favorite crossings are still the spotted salamander tunnels out in western Massachusetts. It's not as if they cause terrible car accidents, but the tunnels allow them to go under the streets and they don't get squished.
Pregnancy is life-changing and exciting for a lot of women, but bringing a baby into the world can also be challenging, especially for mothers-to-be who are struggling with abuse, homelessness, or drug addiction. Now, some of them are finding solace through a program that helps them write lullabies before their children are born. Andrea Shea from member station WBUR has more.
Caitlin Gillespie remembers exactly what she was doing when she got the big news.
I found out I was pregnant when I got arrested.
The 33-year-old says she was stealing to support her decades-long drug habit.
I started my junior year of college with opiates, pills.
Then she moved on to her drug of choice.
Heroin, yeah.
Gillespie says she's overdosed on heroin 6 times. She tried to quit but couldn't. Gillespie and her boyfriend were homeless in Boston for 2 years when they learned she was 3 months along. She says her mind raced as she sat in a county correctional facility.
How was I going to do this? You know, I'm in jail. I have nothing. I have no one. I mean, my family had pretty much stopped talking to me. Part of me felt like maybe this could be the thing that could change everything. But at the same time, you know, fear of the unknown and not knowing what was going to happen. So it was a really difficult thing for me to get through.
Her fears made it hard to connect with the baby growing inside her. Then Gillespie's social worker told her about a unique project at the Boston Medical Center that matches challenged pregnant women and new mothers with musicians so they can write and sing lullabies to their babies.
I didn't think I could sing. I didn't think I could write a song.
It is a strange thing to ask somebody to do who has never written a song, to just come in and share openly, and it feels like a scary thing to ask somebody to do.
That's Elizabeth Moore, a violist with the string ensemble Palaver, which introduced the National Lullaby Project to the hospital. Moore and another musician guided Gillespie through the process. First, they asked her to write a simple, honest letter to her daughter, Harper Rose.
She had written a part in the letter about imagining Harper's first words and first steps, and the whole first verse ended up being based around that idea. And it turns out Caitlin loves to sing and is a complete natural.
Baby steps in your first words, I'll be there for you, by your side, to comfort you, sing lullabies, rock you to sleep when you cry. Harper Rose.
The main thing that I wanted to get across was that any choices that she made, whatever she chooses to do in life, that I would be there no matter what.
The musicians record the lullabies so the women can listen while they're pregnant.
When they hear the song, they just discover a side that in some ways I think it touches them, because they have to admit that they never thought that would be possible or that they forgot that side.
That's Moises Fernandez-Villa, founding director of the hospital's Arts Lab. It's a collaboration between Boston University's School of Fine Arts and the medical campus. Fernandez-Villa and social workers identify women who would benefit most from the Lullaby Project. He remembers when Caitlin Gillespie sang her lullaby for the first time in front of the group. A silence fell over the room.
And it was a silence of just acknowledging that something true has happened. We just have tasted someone's heart. And someone has just offered that to us. It's just so powerful and so brave. I just think these moms are heroes.
For a lot of the moms, he says just showing up is Herculean. Many struggle with addiction, poverty, and homelessness. Fernandez-Villa also gives credit to the 14 Palaver musicians. Palaver and Gillespie have performed her lullaby many times in places like Boston and also at Carnegie Hall, where the growing Lullaby Project originated. More than 60 mothers, ages 16 to 44, have written personal lullabies there. A study shows the women reported feeling more connected to their babies, partners, and families because of the experience. Gillespie says the Lullaby Project definitely helped her bond with her baby.
Especially when I sang it and then heard it played back, and every time that I would play it for someone, it became more real. And then I think even more so once I had her and I played that song and remembered like those feelings that I had before I wrote the song and how different I felt when she was actually there. You gonna sing with me?
La, 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 la.
Ready? Baby steps.
Now Harper Rose is 10 months old, and Gillespie says her daughter is giving her a reason to stay clean.
For anyone with addiction, like, it's not the drugs. Like, we choose the drugs because there's something missing.
These days, Caitlin Gillespie, Harper Rose, and Harper's dad live in temporary housing. The new mom recently got a job waiting tables and is training to be a yoga teacher.
Harper Rose, you're what I always dreamed of.
For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, music courtesy of APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.